You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Empire State of Mind by James Pogue. I had never really thought of someone like Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz, who comes off mostly as a MAGA culture warrior, as an anti-imperialist renegade. But to Bannon, it was all linked. Even populist Democrats are neoliberal neocons, a phrase he loves to use to dismiss any politician who doesn't show an interest in unknitting order. To be serious, you've got to be anti-imperial, Bannon said dismissively of Chris Murphy, the senator from Connecticut I was then writing about, who actually shares many traditionalist-sounding critiques of how our connected world has left a void of meaning in people's lives. Bannon said he's out there supporting a $100 billion supplemental for Israel and Ukraine that we absolutely can't afford. Empire is the core mode of power. Unless you're prepared to take on Wall Street and the banks, which for Bannon would mean confronting the very basics of the financial system, you're never going to actually do anything. It's all talk. But people are waking up, he told me. Once you talk about how the system is financed, they are effing furious. A working class audience can understand something's not right with the system, but they can't put their finger on it. Bannon, who calls his audience the Army of the Awakened, has made it his mission to spell it all out. Populism is system versus anti-system. That's the whole story. Republicans in all these super red MAGA districts who don't get it are going to get attacked, he said. There's going to be a revolution in this country, one way or another. There was a pivotal moment at the summit. Long into the parade of pronouncements and panels that had started to blur. At one point, I stumbled upon Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau giving a press conference to a dozen bleary-eyed reporters. But everyone was riveted and watching when Biden made his joint appearance with Zelensky. Biden, barely 2 weeks out from his debate debacle, gave his short intro speech. Then he turned and introduced Zelensky as President Putin. I'd had a long and candid talk with a senior official from a European power who was so concerned about maintaining the carefully orchestrated presentation of the summit that he at first wouldn't even let me quote him anonymously. But when Trump picked Vance shortly after the end of the summit, he called me to suss out what the pick would mean, and in return he agreed to speak for this piece. I'll tell you from my perspective, he said, about the President Putin moment. Power is a retinue. You're the president of France, you know, and you have this retinue. And everybody who was important was there with their retinues. And when he introduced President Putin, everyone gasped and was looking at each other. It was like, now it's all over. He sketched a picture of a global power structure that very much rests on a public faith that's faltering. The incredible thing about being at that summit, he said, is that on the inside, you're walking through these rooms where you see decades and decades of material about how they've basically manufactured consent. People like Bannon didn't invent resistance to the American empire. In the beginning, there was this huge skepticism, this European said, referring to 1949, when the NATO alliance began. From very early on, they set up these things called NATO information centers that were basically think tanks to explain and justify it. Organizations like the German Marshall Fund and the Atlantic Council have made it all more sophisticated, occupying a quasi-official role in defending the global order. Public perception is paramount, which is why Biden's gaffe produced such horror. The actual point of NATO is not to talk about values and the global order, the European said. It's about how to scimitar through Russian armies or do operations through the skies of the Baltic. All that got hammered out in secret. Then every year at these conclaves, they do the political messaging. A thunderstorm finally broke the heat that had made setting foot outside so miserable. The sky took on an apocalyptic shade of green as I looked out over the White House. For a while, I was trapped at the bar at the Hotel Washington as the storm finally erupted. And for a moment, the crazed bustle that had taken over D.C. paused to let the rain pass. When the weather settled, I took a bike I'd borrowed from my hotel's front desk and rode it over to the Capitol Hilton to meet a man named Sumantra Maitra, who'd just spoken at NatCon, where Vance had given the keynote, and people were spilling out to drink and party. We went over to the bar at P.J. Clark's to talk. Maitra, 38, was born in India, had been raised in New Zealand and England, and now lives in Richmond, where he has taken on a role as the Director of Research for the American Ideas Institute, which publishes American Conservative. The magazine is avowedly anti-global, but Maitra seems set to eventually join the long line of immigrants from Henry Kissinger to Zbigniew Brzezinski to Zalmay Khalilzad, who have had a senior role in managing the American empire. To me, he used his catchphrase, a dormant NATO, to describe America's security focus shifting away from Europe as it recedes from the role as guarantor of world security. We can have bilateral relations, he said, and tell partners, this is your responsibility now, because we've got other things to do. I don't really think the U.S. is a smart empire, he said. Our systems of power have grown too haphazardly. It was more by accident that America came out of World War II in a position of unparalleled strength than by any careful design. Even those cables and data centers in Virginia ended up there because a few early web entrepreneurs happened to find the location near Defense Department research centers convenient. There are two things which you need for an empire, Maitra said. One, you need to have an imperial officer class, which you guys don't have. It's not like the British Empire. You don't train people to be imperials. The second point, echoed Bannon and Vance, empires actually benefit working-class people back in the core. He argued that the British Empire, for all its faults, and Maitra was well aware of these, had effected what Hermann Mark Schwartz, the economist, called the transfer of real resources from the periphery. When defining what it truly means to be an empire, you don't get that benefit for someone who's living in Ohio. The only people who are benefiting are the arms dealers, Boeing, Lockheed, and all that kind of stuff. That's not a smart empire. Bannon sometimes jokes that he's a Leninist, which may sound strange coming from someone who also says that Trump is barely right-wing enough to be on board with the project he's advancing. But everything is scrambled these days. Maitra brought up Lenin, too, and his idea that the fundamental clash is not between capital and labor, as Maitra put it. It's between national capital and international capital. He joked that it would ruin his career if I ended up making him out as a Marxist. But fundamentally, Marx was right, he said, in seeing the forces of international capital and military power as inextricably linked. And in the U.S., the national capital lost, he said, as trade deals like NAFTA and the broader world economic structure sapped the real productive economy that populists of both right and left today want to restore. So it's an economic problem. On the last day of the summit, Schuster, who had to leave early, gave me his pass to get into the so-called public forum. The European official had been cutting when he talked about what was going on in this wing of the convention center, saying that the non-official types covered themselves in shame as they tried to message out a vision of the global order that was completely positive and in which any step back from this vision, like a peace deal that would cede ground in Ukraine, would be a catastrophic blow. This had created a binary. Either you believed fully in the goodness of the system, or you were willing to see it blow up. I arranged to speak with Heather Conley, the head of the German Marshall Fund, a highly polished foreign affairs expert, whom I expected to offer a series of boring talking points. She just finished a conversation with the Dutch Admiral Rob Bauer, marking the final hot wash of the summit, an upbeat analysis of what had clearly been a strained few days. In the West, we have to understand it's not a given, he'd said, security and stability. Offstage, Conley gave a surprisingly candid picture. I think what we've done a poor job of is, she said, we have lost the American people in this conversation. Our bargain was that we said, we got this, the Washington elites and foreign policy specialists. And for the last 20 years, it hasn't felt like we've gotten it right. She was ready to face a crisis of faith. We failed, she said, and so now we have to have a very new conversation with the American people to describe what's at stake, what it's going to cost, and what happens if we are not successful. Conley was acutely aware that regular Americans were suddenly asking big questions about the system that shaped their world, and she wanted to convince them that Bannon's project of unmasking the empire would have dire consequences. What we are experiencing, she said optimistically, is the rebirth of the transatlanticist. And we have Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping to thank for that. Civilizational struggle is coming. The bar of the Marriott, attached to the convention center, had somehow remained open to the public through all the extreme security measures, and that's where I watched Biden's final press conference of the summit. I streamed it on my laptop as I sat next to a middle-aged black NCIS officer who sardonically asked the Russian bartender what he'd thought of the crowds that week. I was taught that if you have nothing nice to say, the bartender replied, say nothing. A pair of journalist friends I knew from covering the African operations of the Wagner Group, the Russian mercenary outfit, joined me, and we ended up talking to a 25-year-old Ukrainian named Yana Rudenko, who'd been trapped in the Kyiv suburb of Bucha when Russian troops captured it, and had survived the massacre of hundreds of civilians before the Russians were forced to withdraw. Now she was living as a refugee in the Netherlands and was leading a crowdsourced effort to produce homemade drones. She'd won something called the NATO Youth Challenge, rewarding people who worked to support the alliance's mission. She got emotional, describing her appreciation for the way that America had, at least at first, unified and made a national effort to support Ukraine's effort. But she struggled with how Western leaders talked of Ukraine as a signal that it was time to prepare their own countries for war. Today it was bittersweet when they said, "We can learn from Ukraine," she said. "F off, you're going to learn from Ukraine, but we're dying for that knowledge." She apologized for swearing and said again how much she appreciated NATO's support. But when you get down to it, the point of the anti-ship missiles and fighter bombers and drone swarms was to wreck infrastructure and kill human beings. "They're using us to change the standards," she said, "but it's Ukrainians who are dying. So, in that sense, I'm angry because they are exploiting us." After the summit, I flew to Nashville for a very different sort of gathering to discuss the future of the world order. This was a private event I'd been invited to by the editors of IM 1776, a well-designed intellectual quarterly giving voice to the most nationalist currents of today's American right. I first learned of the magazine when I heard a podcast interview with Samuel Finley, an Oklahoman and Afghanistan vet who published a piece in one of its earliest issues called Kefaba in Kiev. The title borrowed a term from professional wrestling, used to describe the play-acted dramas that promoters hype to sell tickets. Finley suggested that American leaders were now using the same tactics to gin up support for a grand imperial project. He wrote that there was a bloodlust running like a current through liberals, clearly stoked in them by the managerial class. In the interview, Finley described a view that you hear commonly now on the right, and that clarifies the whole confusing picture of how a belief of rootedness and tradition fits with hatred of global capital, and in turn with resistance to the military-industrial complex. The latter two of these views run contrary to everything the American right has stood for since World War II. But now people like Finley have come around to the same awakening that Bannon is trying to foment, that this system works against the interest of the kinds of people who actually believed in and served our military. Today, Finley said, you've got this class of people who don't think in terms of countries. You'll often hear in conservative circles that America's warrior class, which on the right is often believed to be from ethnically Scotch-Irish, disproportionately Southern families who treat military service as family heritage, have been the ones who bled to build our empire and ended up with NAFTA, fentanyl, and a coastal establishment that sees them and their values as backward and dangerous. Few high-level policymakers or elected officials I've spoken to seem to understand how quickly this kind of view has spread in America, but it's at least part of the reason that, with the exception of the Marine Corps, every branch of the U.S. military is now facing a recruitment shortage. Our military is made up of a diverse set of volunteers and attracts true believing fighters from all kinds of ethnic backgrounds. But it's struggling with a rapid drop in recruitment from its traditional base of young white men. Finley described going to a veterans meeting and seeing old men who stood up and talked about how they'd fought for God and country. And I remember getting mad, he said, because I know for a fact that nobody on the other side of their oath thinks in terms of countries, let alone God. They know we believe in these things and they'll manipulate, he said. Southerners are the janissaries of the managerial class, and that is a fact. We love this thing like nobody else, and yet this thing hates us. The IM 1776 event in Nashville was a party and talk with Eric Prince, the Michigan industrial scion and former Navy SEAL who founded the private military company Blackwater, and who during the Iraq War became a figure symbolizing the entire cozy alignment of militarism and corporate power that shaped the second Bush administration. But Prince has spent the last few years telling a very different story about Blackwater's role in Iraq and why he'd created the company. In this version, awash in fake dollars printed by the Fed, its leaders captured by the totalizing ideology that the whole world should be brought into the American system. The American military became too inefficient and unserious to fight a real war. Whether it's a military that can't get it done in Iraq or Afghanistan, he said that evening, or how we've allowed dudes in flip-flops to shut down the Suez Canal, he let the thought sit for a minute. And then Prince said that America needs to look as I once quoted Vance saying in this magazine, to Andrew Jackson, who was a great president, and by the way, against central banking, he said to a loud cheer. He said that the so-called spoils system Jackson had introduced to the federal civil service, allowing a president to freely hire allies and fire enemies, should come back, echoing what Trump has made very clear he intends to do in clearing house across the government. Then Prince brought it back to the dollar. The military had become so large and unaccountable, he said, because of flat currency, where Congress can just appropriate an extra $1 trillion a year, spending it on itself and on stupidity. It's like America on unlimited donuts. Mark Granza, the editor-in-chief of IM-1776, told me that 250 or so people had showed up to the brewery where the event was being held, on the periphery of the massive Bitcoin conference that had brought 20,000 people to town and where Trump himself was soon to give a speech. Prince is a star in these circles, but I was still shocked by how many people I knew who'd shown up, special forces veterans and backwoods preppers and a great number of big names from Twitter, some of whom aren't right-wing. The event was organized in part by Nick Allen, who runs Sovereign House, the downtown Manhattan event space that is the semi-official headquarter of the Dime Square scene of edgy and often right-wing writers and artists. Allen introduced me to Prince as I walked in. He was noticeably fit and unassuming, of medium height, and dressed casually in jeans and a checked button-down shirt with his sleeves rolled up to the elbow. We chatted for a while about how I'd just been arrested and deported from the Central African Republic under the belief that I was secretly working for an American military contractor, a different one. Then I left Prince to the hovering cloud of fans that circled him the whole night. "Stay safe out there," he told me. "It's a hard job you've got." After the event, which was otherwise off the record, I smoked a cigarette with Granza, and he clarified that I could quote what had been said during the question-and-answer discussion Prince had with an IM-1776 editor. The discussion kept circling back to the dollar. The IM-1776 editor noted that today America spends more on the debt's interest than on the military. Prince had said we needed to take whatever legal means necessary to drastically cut the federal budget. "Do you think we're at a point," the editor asked, "if drastic measures weren't taken, that things spin off the rails fiscally?" "We are definitely approaching Weimar levels of debt," Prince said. "And look, the dollar, as the reserve currency of the world, is underpinned by the illusion of U.S. military hegemony. And when we fail continuously, our friends see that, and our enemies really see that. So they're probing and testing, and the more we overuse sanctions, the more people move away." A shift from the dollar as a global reserve currency would cause wrenching shock in America, he continued. But it would at least force America to bring its spending back in line with the actual capacity of our production. This would mean wrecking our social security system or our defense apparatus or possibly both. But according to his view, our spending is so disconnected from our material reality that it would still be entirely a good thing. He talked at last about the obvious geopolitical issue at hand. "Look, Putin invading Ukraine," he said, "I'm not condoning that." But he echoed the view expressed often on the right, and even more often on the anti-imperialist left, in saying that as the NATO alliance expands ever closer to Russia's borders, it might expect a backlash. At this point, he said, NATO is not really an alliance. It's a protectorate. He praised Trump, echoing credit that Stoltenberg has implicitly given the former president as well, though few in the alliance like to admit what provoked the shift. for pushing NATO members to increase their defense spending, but he still marveled at the fact that America accepts so much of the responsibility for guaranteeing the safety of countries like Germany. "It's the third wealthiest country in the world," he said, "and they're completely unserious about it. They couldn't give two shits. I don't know why we taxpayers need to fund that effort anymore." Germany, where Chancellor Olaf Scholz had only recently promised the country would launch a so-called Zeitenwende, rearming itself after more than a half century in which it had shied away from trying to act as a military power, has seen its industrial sector badly hurt by U.S. sanctions on Russian gas exports, and has no plans to massively cut spending on its welfare state. The country recently announced that, facing budgetary reality, it won't even have money to help Ukraine's war effort, and Germany is, by far, the biggest economy in Europe. Britain's new Labour Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, came into power promising to bring the UK's military spending up to 2.5% of its GDP, which in the long scheme of history is a vanishingly small portion of a nation's economy to spend on keeping itself safe. But to do this, he will have to find money by raising taxes, threatening to drive London's already shrinking financial center to Frankfurt or Paris, or by cutting social services and the entire basic social contract of European society is built on a promise of health services and a safety net of the kind America has never had. Not long ago, Prince made headlines by suggesting that the West needs to colonize Africa again. At the Nashville event, he circled back to this. Western governments, as he sees it, can barely manage to fund and maintain their own systems at this point. To the people at this gathering, whom he spoke to as savvy enough about the crisis he sees, the opportunity lies in building outside the unraveling system. "It's not the U.S. government sending people," he said. "F that. It's private cities initiatives, the disciplines that we take for granted here." He suggested a privateer model of irregular warfare against Mexican cartels and to punish China for exporting the precursor chemicals used to make the fentanyl that kills almost 70,000 Americans every year. "I think fire is an underutilized tool, and burning down all those facilities in China, we send a very good message," he said. "If you send the U.S. military, that's going to escalate. But if you just put bounties and actually pay them, say, on cartel guys, it's going to go away. You'll see a lot of independent city-states, smaller pockets of capitalism and good governance, and people enjoying things more locally," he said. "There would be pockets of sophisticated, peaceful, desirable society in a world that grew increasingly chaotic. The U.S. Navy protecting the world's shipping lanes," he said, "that's not going to continue. The future, sadly, is a lot less certain and a lot more violent." I stayed in Nashville through the end of the Bitcoin conference. I watched Trump address the VIPs in a packed hall, which erupted when he promised to fire Securities and Exchange Commission Chair Gary Gensler and promised to create a federal strategic reserve of Bitcoin. This spoke to a distrust of the dollar that is slowly creeping into the mainstream. Heading out of Trump's talk, I encountered Ro Khanna, the Democratic congressman who represents a district covering most of Silicon Valley. Khanna has an ongoing love-hate buddy act with Bannon, but he shares a critique that often cuts across old left-right divisions. "Bannon has praised me a bunch of times," he told me once. He says, "Watch out for this guy, Ro Khanna. He's taking our song lyrics." There was a naivete in the 80s and 90s that Western liberalism would be the end of history and end of conflict. There was this provincialism about Western liberalism that it was the only path, he told me. The policies of globalization have not worked. I left and went to the book reading for a writer named Joe Allen a few blocks from the convention center. Allen's book, Dark Aeon, colors our new tech-dominated society as an infernal machine that has robbed us of, among other things, connection to natural life. I was surprised to learn that he worked for Bannon's War Room podcast as the show's tech correspondent. We had a beer, and I asked him how much Bannon shared his worldview. Steve's in prison right now, he shrugged, and I'm sure when he gets out, he'll be very pissed about the things I've been saying. But what else is new? Allen brought up transhumanism, the idea that liberalism, tech, and capitalism have come together in a sort of unholy trinity to distort natural human reality in our new age. The important connection between the pro-populist and anti-transhumanist in Steve's mind, Allen said, is that Steve is sticking up for the legacy Americans. And legacy Americans are very much creatures of tradition, and by and large, creatures of traditional religion. Steve is extraordinarily hostile to the excesses of capitalism, he said. To use a loaded term, he continued, Bannon saw the entire complex of capital, empire, and tax as unholy. This may sound vague, and it may sound illogical, but if there is one thing to understand about the global populist movement, it's that to many people involved in it, this feeling arises implicitly, without need for explanation. We each found our way to it, Bannon told Dugin during their 2018 meeting, the tradition. The night before I left Nashville, I went to a bar alone to hear some country music. The house band closed with a cover of a song that is now probably the single most reliable crowd pleaser in red-hued America. Donald Trump Jr. uses it as his walk-on music at rallies. It was courtesy of The Red, White, and Blue by Toby Keith, who died earlier this year from stomach cancer. After 9/11, this song became the anthem for a slice of nationalist Americans who still wholeheartedly believed that the U.S. military was a noble fighting force defending freedom and the American way of life. Now it's a song conservatives often perform at karaoke bars with a tone of irony and wistfulness. The money line comes in the second verse. Justice will be served and the battle will rage, it starts. This big dog will bite when you rattle his cage. The crowd got ready, and the cowboy-headed singer began to slow down so they would be hungry for the payoff. And you'll be sorry that you messed with the U.S. of A., he sang, waiting for the crowd to get to its feet and be ready to scream along, 'cause we'll put a boot in your ass. Everyone was yelling along now. It's the American way. Two young guys in town from rural Georgia shouted along with this line so loudly and proudly that the band's microphones picked their voices up from the stage. They hugged and pumped their fist. One of them saw me observing them and gave me a wink and a sheepish shrug. Nobody actually believes in this stuff anymore, he seemed to admit, but it was still fun to get drunk on a Saturday night and pretend that kicking ass and dropping hellfire missiles serves the cause of the American project. I first reached out to Ben Rhodes, Barack Obama's most influential foreign policy advisor, by email while I was at the NATO summit, hoping to talk without the filter of press minders and handlers. We both live in L.A., so when I got home, we met for coffee in Venice. He wore a faded black T-shirt and a Zabar's baseball cap, and he seemed in some ways still exhausted from his years in government. He was very quick to say that the American system was indeed an empire, and he clearly thought a great deal about what this meant. There's two ways of looking at this, he said. I think the lazier way is that the U.S. has hundreds of military installations all over the world and has territories that most Americans don't even know we have. But this was just the obvious part. The more accurate version is that most of the system under which the world functions is U.S. created, managed, perpetuated. So everything from the global financial system to the network of security alliances that we'd built around the world were all built to plug into American wealth. The dollar is the world's currency, he went on. The U.S. controls the global financial system. The U.S. consistently weaponizes sanctions to try to compel countries to do what we want. He seemed to be amused by the idea that a system like this was anything other than an empire. People separate out our military footprint from our financial footprint, he said. But the reason that people have to trust that the dollar is a reliable currency is because it's literally backed by the United States military, even though that's not what we say the mission of the United States military is. We ended up talking for 3.5 hours about the tiring complexity of this system and the incredibly difficult problems he'd experienced in helping manage it. He'd helped negotiate the deal to normalize relations with Cuba, the Iran nuclear deal, and the Paris Climate Accords. He shares, in fact, many criticisms of this grand imperial system that are being raised now on the populist right. I guess where we differ, he said, it's this effort to evolve the system while keeping it roughly in place. He just published a piece in Foreign Affairs arguing for a new global arrangement that would acknowledge an emerging multipolar order while leaving in place America's system of alliances and the basic plumbing. I don't believe in just pulling the plug. We talked a lot about why he'd moved to L.A. with his wife and 2 kids, away from the D.C. world where people thought constantly about this stuff, and why he had no desire to go back. It had put him in an impossible bind. I think the innovation of the Bannon and Vance project, he said, is that it's forced the left to become defenders of the very institutions they're supposed to be skeptical of, like the CIA, like the broader intelligence community, like NATO. The Social Democratic government in Germany, or the Labour government in the UK, he said, are now propping up structures that your own constituencies are skeptical of. It's an uncomfortable place to be. He talked about reading as a teenager about CIA-backed death squads in Latin America, and now suddenly I'm in a party that is the vocal defender of the nobility of the U.S. intelligence apparatus, he said. And it's not just the geopolitical sense, it's bankers too. We are now defending global capitalism and NATO and the entire enterprise of neoliberalism. He gave an anecdote from when he was reporting his book titled After the Fall, The Rise of Authoritarianism in the World We've Made. I remember I was sitting with this guy who was in the Hong Kong opposition in a shopping mall, and I was feeling very sympathetic to him. And I remember realizing today, in 2019, I have more in common with this guy than with most of America. There's something new about that, he said. When I was growing up, I would have just had massively more shared reference points with my family in Texas. That's something that is a challenge to people, to liberals, because I like the idea that we're all the same, we're all equal. I'm just as curious about and value as much the humanity of some guy in Hong Kong as somebody in Texas. Isn't that where this is all supposed to evolve? Global leaders, he said, need to reckon with a world that can never truly be flat, as the optimistic liberal phrasing once envisioned it would be. Otherwise, we're ultimately going to lose everything, because then Bannon is going to capture that pushback, he said. We need to have a national identity that ties this all together, he said, and everyone agrees that there is a problem here. We all see it. The divide is between people who want to try to bring things down to a soft landing and people who want to blow it up. The challenge, he said, is that nobody has shown me you can blow it up absent a war and a mass disruptive event. We paid for our coffee, and I headed to my truck, but he lingered for a moment at the Venice Beach outlet of Superba Food and Bread, where it's always possible to see celebrities having brunch. Of course, no one recognized him. Americans have long enjoyed the luxury of not caring much about the people insulating us from war and chaos. No one asked for his autograph or to share a selfie, and no one would have guessed that just a few years ago, his job had been to help keep the whole thing from spinning out of control. In plain sight. Amateur art sleuth Clifford Shorer III has helped find lost works by Durer, Rembrandt, and Rubens. Now he's embarked on his greatest discovery yet, cracking a 43-year-old cold case. By Adam Leith Gulner, with opening photograph by Diana Markosian. 21st Century Sherlock, self-taught art detective Clifford Scharer III, who divides his time between London, Boston, Vermont, and Mashpee, Massachusetts, at his modernist home in Provincetown, Massachusetts. On the evening of April 7, 2021, the amateur art detective Clifford Scharer III was seated on a couch in his glass house. In silence, he opened a manila envelope that had been sent to him by a respected Massachusetts attorney. The packet contained evidence related to an unsolved crime. Scharer's mid-century modern home, designed in 1956 by Bauhaus founder Walter Gropius, sits atop a majestic dune at the western edge of Provincetown. Its floor-to-ceiling windows offer 270-degree views of the seascape below. After dark, with the lights on, the glass house glows like a television screen. Since Scharer and his spouse, Chris, never closed the front blinds, passersby can actually see into the home, as if watching a show about a sleuth who tracks down missing artworks. Had you peered through the panes on that spring night, you might have spied Scharer in front of the fireplace on his Danish modern sofa, leafing through photocopied pages, seeking clues as he often does. "Your interesting package has now found its way to my hand," he would write the lawyer who had mailed the envelope. In fact, he had told that attorney some weeks earlier, "You know what I do all day long? I look for paintings." Scharer already had a reputation for finding lost masterpieces worth millions, but this dossier contained the makings of his biggest case yet. The documents related to a 1978 home invasion in Worcester, Massachusetts, during which 9 highly valuable paintings were taken, including works by several old masters. The stolen art, Scharer calculated, would now be worth roughly $34 million. Like the 1990 hit at Boston's Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, in which 13 pieces, estimated at $500 million, had been swiped, the Worcester mystery ranked among America's most confounding art heist. For decades, there'd been no cracks in the case. But then again, Clifford Scharer III had never looked into it. Scharer has quite a track record. In 2019, he uncovered an original Albrecht Dürer, today valued at 8 figures. Remarkably, it had wound up in a yard sale for $30. Vienna's Der Standard deemed this no less than a find of the century. Scharer seemed to concur, telling the New York Times, "I'll never have an experience like that again." But when it comes to unearthing overlooked and underpriced art trophies, he keeps repeating that experience. His identification and retrievals, he says, are the equivalent of being struck by a kind of electricity multiple times. In Cliff's case, lightning strikes a lot, explains Jim Whalo, director emeritus of the Worcester Art Museum, WAM. It's just not a fluke in his life. It's part of his DNA. Over the past decade or so, Scharer has stumbled across 2 Van Dykes and relocated 5 Turners. He's been restoring an altarpiece fragment attributed to El Greco that he suspects was rescued from a burning church during the Spanish Civil War. He regularly identifies or re-identifies work by significant old masters listed as by an unidentified artist. His specialty is the forgotten Rembrandt or Rubens that has somehow slipped between the cracks and ended up, in his words, sleeping in plain sight. His hunches don't always prove correct. He's been suckered by at least a few forgeries or phonies. Sometimes you follow threads that turn into an unraveling sweater, he admits. But many filaments he's followed have led to veritable treasures. The previously unrecorded Van Harlem he spotted in New Jersey that now hangs in the Art Institute of Chicago. a Cezanne he snagged from a Campbell Soup heiress and helped place in Ireland's National Gallery, and three possibilities he scooped up on the cheap that were subsequently reattributed to the Milanese maestro, Danielle Crespi. He also owns four works from Rembrandt's studio, he claims, including two that I believe are by the master himself. Shorer, who does not hold a university degree in art history, is largely self-taught and makes many of his finds in his spare time. He also employs runners to scour auctions around the world in search of hidden gems. All day and night, he says, we send pictures back and forth by WhatsApp going, do we think this is this? The Sunday Times Magazine, UK, describes him as being well-known in the art world for his eye. Shorer formulates it slightly differently. I'm known in the art world for rediscovering lost things. Despite having left high school at age 15, Shorer, 58, is an exceptionally knowledgeable, if mercurial, and at times elusive man. He is lanky, with piercing dark eyes, short-cropped hair, and a trim white beard. I'm no one, with no particular education, he stated in an oral history project for the Smithsonian's Archives of American Art. I come to it with an open pair of eyeballs. The types of paintings Shorer seeks are known as sleepers. A sleeper is the name that the picture trade bestows upon a work being sold below its true value because it is mistakenly thought to be fake, specious, a probable copy, or the work of an inconsequential artist. A sleeper hunter is an individual like Shorer who stalks such errors or misattributions in listings at auctions. Whenever he acquires sleepers, he joins forces with experts to reassess and properly catalog the paintings. Then, he and his team often unload them at a profit to blue-chip institutions, using the proceeds to procure more beauties. Shorer's success at rousing sleepers enabled him to put together the investment group that purchased the venerable London Gallery Agnew's in 2014. He then acquired a 290-acre forest in Vermont. Recently, he became the owner of a Gatsby-style mansion on an approximately 4-acre private island in the Long Island Sound, where J.P. Morgan's great-grandson has resided. Shorer is renovating the place to sell. I first met him in New York City after a Christie's auction, where he just won a Turner for more than $1 million. His intent was for Agnew's to offer it over the coming years at a higher price to the European market. What moves him, however, isn't lucrative deals. He isn't an art dealer at all. Instead, he contends that his goals are threefold: to resurrect forsaken or neglected artworks, to repatriate pieces spoliated by the Nazis, and to die in possession of a single perfect painting, ideally an unobtainable Leonardo. This last aspiration could require selling everything else he owns, but as he once said, I don't mind living in a cardboard box. When asked where he normally lives, He replies a tad testily, I don't really normally live anywhere. He divides his time between Provincetown and homes in Boston, London, and Mashpee, Massachusetts. He attends art fairs, lectures, and meetings in Europe once or twice a month. A favorite pastime, he says, is going to symposia that end just short of fisticuffs between scholars about attribution. A collector and art lover, Shorer is above all a dedicated investigator. He compares the way his mind works to those wall-mounted corkboards in classic crime shows, the kind with thumbtacked photos of suspects and murder scenes and corroborating evidence, all linked together by pieces of string. Instead of a Sherlock Holmes-style magnifying glass, he uses precision binocular headband magnifiers, large benchtop microscopes, reverse image searches in online databases, and high-tech tactics, such as MAXRF spectroscopy or dendrochronology. that apply laboratory analytics to decode a painting's makeup and approximate age. As cutting-edge as his forensics may be, however, Shorer, upon receiving that envelope in April 2021, found himself getting pulled into a strangely old-fashioned cold case. The dossier consisted of whatever scant information was available about the nine paintings that had vanished in 1978, 43-year-old police reports, original bills of sale, insurance documents, invoices, and most importantly to Shorer, photocopied reproductions of the actual trove. Two Pissarros, two Renoirs, a Boudin, a Turner, and some intriguing old Dutch paintings. The theft had personal implications. Several of the works had been bound for the permanent collection of WAM, where Shorer had previously served as board president, and where a number of canvases he owns are currently on view. Yet despite his ties to the museum, no one had ever given him a clear description of the artworks taken in 1978 until the file arrived. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.